welcome to The Final Draft, your weekly half-hour romp in the world of books and writing on 2SER 107.3. I'm Genevieve McGregor. Tonight, a show all about revisiting and reimagining Australian history. We talk with two authors who have taken inspiration from key figures and events in the history of this country for their new novels. First up, the controversial dismissal of Prime Minister Gough Whitlam in 1975 is the basis of Nicholas Hasluck's new political thriller. Ned Ivanovac speaks with him about family, politics and the Cold War. We also hear from author and actor Peter Docker about his second novel, The Water Boys, which is set in an apocalyptic future in a continent caught up in a violent struggle for control of water. I speak with him about violence, grog and his relationship to country. All coming up on The Final Draft.
Time out, and Smirnoff's new Sydney iPhone app has 5,000 things to do in Sydney in the palm of your hand. It's updated hourly and includes the latest events, festivals, gigs, current film releases, bars and restaurants. Download it now from the App Store or from timeout.com/Sydney. And did we mention that it's free? Time Out Magazine, Sydney. Sponsors of 2SER.
The dismissal of Prime Minister Gough Whitlam in 1975 remains one of the most controversial events of Australian political history. In his new political thriller, Dismissal, Nicholas Hasluck has crafted a tale that spans some of the most momentous events of the Cold War in Australia, including the Petrov Soviet espionage case to the atomic testing of the Pacific. Barrister Roy Temple, an advisor to the Whitlam government, negotiates half-truths and betrayals as he scrambles against time to prevent the dismissal. Final Draft's Ned Ivanovac spoke to Nicholas about his family's involvement in politics, fictionalising real people, and the Shakespearean qualities of government.
The centre of this drama is the dismissal of the Whitlam government, and of course, as we know, politics is like that. Parliament House is always rife with rumour and speculation. We've seen that in recent times and real life situations such as the overthrowing of Kevin Rudd and so on. I mean, things can happen dramatically in the space of 24 hours, and often people with an interest in the whole matter don't necessarily know the whole story because they're only being told half the story. And I suppose essentially I'm describing a very seething political situation, albeit back then in 1975.
What was it about the dismissal that struck you as the moment in Australian history that would be worth novelising?
Well, firstly, because it's a unique moment. Nothing like this has ever happened before or since. So, I mean, simply as a matter of history, it's a unique moment. But secondly, it also has all the kind of classic elements like a Shakespearean drama. You have larger-than-life figures such as Whitlam and Fraser, both physically big men, both interested in getting or retaining power. So you've got the relationship between the characters. Gough Whitlam was the one who appointed Sir John Kerr to office as Governor General, and then Kerr came to the conclusion that he was going to take a decision to dismiss the Prime Minister who had appointed him. All of that suggests that there's bound to be issues of trust and whether there was any degree of betrayal in the relationship between those two principal figures. So, I mean, the whole thing does have an element of Shakespearean tragedy.
How does one go about fictionalising people that you have in fact met that were historical players?
I'm basically utilising a technique that the American novelist Gore Vidal has employed of having dealing with some characters and events in history. The mode is that the real characters, in this case the Whitlams, the Barwick, Fraser, Kerr, etc., are figures in the background, and the main action is taking place in the foreground with the fictional characters. And of course, first amongst them is the main protagonist, Roy Temple, a barrister from the Sydney Bar who becomes an advisor to the Whitlam government.
How did you conceive of Roy's story in the first place?
In a real-life drama of this kind, you have to say, well, what can the novelist bring to it that a journalist or a historian can't? The important thing is to try and give the reader a feeling of what it was like on the day, and I've been using my fictional characters to do that. Now, Roy Temple, the barrister who becomes an advisor to the Whitlam government, I suppose it just seemed that I needed almost a narrator close to the scene of the action. a couple of the main players at least, such as Gough Whitlam himself and Sir John Kerr, the Governor-General, were both from the Sydney Bar, so it seemed to fall into place that I would create a fictional barrister of about their own age and experience, so that would fit in naturally that this Roy Temple, the fictional character, might be part of the action.
And then you wove into that the Petrov affair and the communist insinuations and allegations hovering over Roy's head.
Yes, that is right. I guess that's just because if you're going to write a novel about this, you've got to bring some extra ingredients to the drama, otherwise you may as well just read a journalist's account. So that made it necessary to flesh out the character of Roy Temple with some background, and I gave him a background as someone who had been in the Department of External Affairs with Dr. Evatt and others and had been caught up in the drama of the Petrov Commission back in the 1950s, with allegations hanging over his head that he may have been part of a Soviet espionage system or something of the kind. So this is all adding a level of intrigue to the plot.
Was there something about the paranoia and the over-the-shoulder movements of that time that you thought would be a really juicy element to weave into the story?
Oh, very much so, very much so. It's an era I've always been interested in the course of researching this book. I did some work in Washington and the Library of Congress, and hence you get the figure of Alger Hiss, leading U.S. State Department official who was accused of being part of a Soviet espionage system. And so I sort of translate some of that into the Australian scene, and yes, it was all with a view to having this Roy Temple, someone with a rather murky sort of background, and this would bear upon what sort of advice he might be giving to the Whitlam government at crucial moments, and including the day of the dismissal itself, 11th November 1975.
Your father was Minister for Territories and had done work in similar areas, and I wondered how much of that had fed into influencing you with stories such as that.
Quite a degree. Yes, he was Minister for Territories in the 1950s and had jurisdiction over Papua New Guinea, the Australian territories. And I, in fact, went to New Guinea with him a couple of times in those days, and it was in a stage when development was underway and all sorts of initiatives were taking place. So I think something of that experience did feed into something I've pondered for many years, the whole notion of developing nations in the Pacific and some of the losses they've had over the years and so on.
The moral heart of the book seems to be the story that you feature, the anthropological report by the anthropologist Simon Dacey about the dispossession of the Pacific Islanders in the 50s due to atomic testing. When the group goes to see the displaced islanders and they're speaking through intermediaries in the hut and looking out to the horizon, there is that real sense of loss.
Yes. Well, I suppose as part of my interest in this whole era, the 1940s, and of course my father was also in the Department of External Affairs at that time and went to the San Francisco conference where the United Nations was formed. At that conference, when the Trusteeship Council for various Pacific nations was being set up, of course I was only a boy myself at the time, but I've taken an interest in it, and particularly the Bikini Islands, 1946, that the atomic bomb testing was taking place at Bikini Island, and of course the islanders had to be removed from there to protect their health and welfare and so on. But of course they were dispossessed or dismissed from their own homeland, and I've always thought that was quite a poignant circumstance.
Your father was also the Governor-General preceding John Kerr, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
It's long been speculated by historians that had he remained in the position, the constitutional crisis of 75 might have ended very differently.
Well, it's a bit hard to second-guess these things, but I think it's an acknowledged fact that although my father came from the liberal side of politics, in fact, he and Gough Whitlam got on very well. They had a good relationship, a very frank and open relationship, so there is the possibility that Whitlam would not have been quite taken by surprise in the way that he seems to have been taken by surprise when he was dismissed by Sir John Kerr. But one just doesn't know.
No, I suppose. I mean, hindsight being 2020.
Hindsight is 2020.
I do wonder what it was like growing up surrounded by those types of personalities. I mean, with your father's work and living in those circles, how much of that seeped in and influenced you?
Oh, quite a deal. I mean, I became a lawyer by training, so I was always interested in the workings of government. I attended dinners and so forth there, and, you know, it was a very enduring memory. And in fact, there is a scene at Government House involving a formal dinner for the Vice President of the United States, and I attended such a dinner myself, and I've obviously...
Not that specific dinner.
Yes, in fact, that specific dinner.
Really?
Yes. Mm.
Well, that is probably the most authentic research that one could do, really, for a story like this.
Yes, well, perhaps the other point I should make is that this story is mostly being told through the fictional characters in the foreground with the real-life characters in the background, but in researching the book and reading all the memoirs by all the principal players, I did take very careful steps to ensure that any real-life figure in the plot is basically saying or doing what he himself admitted saying or doing in his own writing.
So that would take quite a lot of fine-toothed combing to make sure that you were not defaming or putting words in anyone's mouth.
Yes, that's true. That's true. So I've read and researched very widely on this whole thing, but and been through all the Hansards and the speeches and so forth, but I'm confident in my own mind that anything the real-life figures do in the plot is consistent with what they agree that they did.
That was Ned Ivanovac speaking with Nicholas Haslach about his new novel, Dismissal, out now with Fourth Estate. And you're listening to The Final Draft on 2SER. And today we're looking at two authors who have reimagined history in their newest novels. Up next, we talk to Peter Docker about his book, The Water Boys, right after this.
Science made fascinating, weird, disturbing and fun. Diffusion, Mondays at 6:30 p.m. on 2SER.
Peter Docker's latest novel, The Water Boys, begins with two men, Conway and Malarabone, friends and former soldiers, stealing a waterboard truck to smuggle water. It's Western Australia 300 years after colonisation, and Conway, Malarabone and his people are waging a guerrilla war against the Eastern States Water Board, who control the water of the West. Conway is haunted and hunted by the water board and his past. And he also has the ability to dream his way back in time, back to the arrival of Europeans in Western Australia, when Captain Charles Fremantle chose to throw off the mantle of empire. I spoke with Peter over the phone from Broome about violence, the destruction of grog, a possible future, and writing about Aboriginal culture from the inside out.
I picked out one chapter. It's called Watching the Footy with Me Mates. And it's a chapter inspired as much by the kind of events of Abu Ghraib and the intervention in the Northern Territory and these kinds of things, which about kind of sustained torture. And one of the big themes in my book is also the issue of grog in this country. All right. Chapter 10. Watching the footy with my mates. We're watching tally, me and the other waterboard troopers. I look around to see us all lounging around in uniform, my mates and me. We're drinking beer. I'm drinking beer, on the piss with my mates. Maybe my brain has forgotten that soon my body will get sick, or maybe my body has forgotten that soon my brain will get sick, that the disease will grow like a living shadow within me. The other troopers around me, my mates, they seem to know. They know the grog road, and they walk down it as steady as pelting rain. Their heads are up, but slightly too high from the arrogance, and never held straight on, always at an angle from the crazy mix of guilt, lies, greed and righteousness. These troopers walking in the rain of alcohol in my brain, I know the grog dreaming. We all do. On the tally is the footy. Maybe we're walking to the footy. We would be if we weren't slumped on a couch. I'm more slumped than the others. The drugs they've injected me with keep me down here like a long-necked turtle curled up in my shell. I look up from the beer at the end of my arm to the 3D images in front of the wall. Footy. Brown-skinned players with flashy skills flowing across the faraway green of the MCG. That's real grass, comments one of my mates. Bullshit, retorts another. It is. What do they water it with, Bans oil? Laughter. Ah, I add, to which they've got no answer. The camera suddenly goes tight on the only white player. My mates all get excited. He's the first Jenniger for 20 years to play for Collingwood. The fellas all marvel at him, toast him, yell their hopes and dreams into the 3D image in front of us. I hear myself laughing and I don't know why. Even here in my drug-dulled state, wearing the waterboard uniform, there is something else. I know this is a lie, that the heart of the grog dreaming is about lies, about self-delusion. I'm not a trooper. I never played footy. I don't drink grog. Before the waterboard, there was no grog here for 100 years. That old grog will smash me to bits, will destroy me and all the possibilities of me and my children and my children's children. One of my mates slaps my back. I look down at the brown bottle of beer in my hand. That hand is so far away, so totally foreign to me, like it's in a different culture. I concentrate and the bottle slowly begins to travel up towards my face. I fix my eyes on the bottle as though breaking the stare would destroy the levitation trick. As it comes closer, I see it's too high. I've lined it up with my eyes, not my mouth. I adjust the thought and down it comes and clatters into my teeth, my front teeth. At least I've still got them, this thought says from a tiny lost corner of my mind. The cold beer tips down my throat and the bottle is travelling back again until my arm is extended and it is miles away. I don't remember giving the order to move the bottle away again. There's some kind of spring-loaded thing going on. I stare at the brown bottle in my hand as though I'll wear it down and it will confess its allegiance through my withering glare. From somewhere outside of me, I think I hear Malarabone. I can't tell if he's laughing or weeping. Then I know for sure it's him. Something in my reaching drunkenness finds something good and strong to hold on to. I can't tell if I'm laughing or weeping. I know for sure it's Malarabone. He's straining a scream through a grunt as the pain flashes through his body. He must be close, real close, the cell next door. My sloppy grin is lopsided and fake. I notice that I'm dribbling beer and spit on my trooper's uniform. I concentrate on the mouth of the beer bottle. As I gaze at it, it becomes Malarabone's eye, pupils wildly dilated but still fiery bright. The eye winks at me. That wink fills me with strength, like I've been injected with it. And I know what I'm talking about. I've been injected with a lot of shit lately. My muscles tingle as they come alive and stand by. I shift my gaze to my fist. I balance the bottle on the arm of the couch and change my grip to an underhand one. It's like watching grass grow, watching my hand change grip. I turn to the trooper next to me. He laughs and takes a swig from his beer, but the grog gives me a power too. I know that. A power pushing me to the strength of chaos and havoc. I've got to open myself to the grog power. I remember my intact front teeth and bite down hard on my bottom lip without warning, without giving myself a chance to think about it and back out. I bite down hard until my skin splits and the blood mixes with my beer dribble and the pain gives me enough cut-through clarity to see myself as a warrior again. I flash on my grog warrior and smash the bottle into the trooper's face. The other bottle smashes too and he reels backwards, his face a mask of blood and glass. Something hits me from behind. I swing around and slash at the other trooper with the shattered beer bottle in my hand. It hacks into the flesh of his cheek and he screams. Adrenaline is coursing through me now, waking me up. An alarm is sounding all around us. Something else hits me. Glass, beer and blood run down my neck. I turn to confront a third trooper. He smiles at me. I lunge at him, going straight for his throat. We both make contact with our bottles and he goes down. The side of my head feels ripped open. I'm really waking up now. They haven't given me pain for a few days. It's new and fresh and I'm shouting something, I don't know what. Then it filters through. I'm not your mate. I'm not your mate. I'm not your mate.
That's part of a very violent section of your book. While you were writing, were you conscious of how violent that part of the book was?
No, I wasn't, to be honest, Genevieve. Like, when I first began to discuss with my editor, Georgia Richter, one of the first comments she made to me was about how violent it was, and I got really shocked because I hadn't planned that. I didn't even notice it.
Mm. But as you said, you're dealing with issues such as what human beings can do to each other, what grog can do to people as well. And your main character, Conway, grapples with both of these themes in the novel. And he's both a water diviner and a link between the past and the present. Can you tell me about him? Where did he come from?
Well, in one way, he's a very mysterious figure. And he's the kind of figure that our histories don't record. One of the very first inspirations for him, I was reading the diaries, which are in the St Kilda Library, of John Batman, who was the original, the very first protector of Aborigines in Victoria from 1830 onwards. And he mentions on one page a fellow that he meets in Melbourne who is a white man, but who has been through traditional Darragiora law, which is the law for the people, the traditional owners of Sydney. And he never mentions this guy ever again, and the guy doesn't get a mention in any history books anywhere. And it intrigued me that there would be this white man in 1830 in Melbourne who spoke the language of the traditional owners of Sydney and had been through their law with them, so obviously trusted by those people. And so that kind of invisible white man started to intrigue me, that there were guys all the way through history who did have an ability and a foresight to reach out to try to understand Aboriginal cultures, being the kind of spiritual essence of this country that we're now in. That's really the inspiration for a character like Conway.
And as you mentioned, his connections lie with the Aboriginal people as opposed to the water board, who we'll talk a bit about later. And he struggles with his place in the country, doesn't he?
He does. And my own personal experience has been that, you know, as I've become more acceptable and more accepted into Aboriginal societies, I've sort of become less acceptable to white fellas.
Could you talk a bit about your personal journey you've taken to become more included within Aboriginal society?
Well, look, it's a subject I cover intensely in my first book, but it's a very long story. I could start with just where I am now. I live in Broome. My partner works for Pat Dodson, the Aboriginal leader here. It's like my primary relationships really are all with Aboriginal people, and I feel a strong sense that my destiny is intertwined with the destiny of the Aboriginal people in this country. And in the bigger picture, you know, partly what I'm trying to talk about with the book is that to access Indigenous thinking right around the world, and that we as a people, us Westerners, desperately need this information, philosophies and technologies around how to fix up the planet. Now, all that information exists, it just doesn't exist in English.
It's also a bit of a warning, isn't it, that if we don't look after the country, this could happen. The apocalyptic future that the Waterbush boy shows us is pretty scary.
Yeah. Yeah, well, look, I mean, the road we seem to be going down now, you know, especially, you know, because I live in the remote WA where the mining boom is in full swing, nobody seems to care about anything except digging up the ground and, you know, getting the royalties to the government for the profits for the big companies, 90% of which end up, you know, overseas. And so I start to think to myself about what happens when this mining boom is finished. Someone said to me, if it was a movie, what would it be? Well, it's a cross between 12 Monkeys, The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith, and Mad Max.
It was very evocative of Mad Max sometimes,
yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, I mean, Mad Max I always thought was a really great script. I mean, that was the classic Petrol Wars film and story, and inspired by that, you know, I was thinking about the water wars.
Mm. I mean, water and the control of water is the basis of the civil war in The Water Boys, and one of the main characters and one of Conway's enemies, I'd say, is Jack.
Yep.
And the water board of the Coalition of the Eastern States of Australia.
Yep.
Can you tell us about Jack and the water board?
Well, Jack is a half-brother to Conway. The issue of family members finding themselves on the opposite side to each other is an issue that is kind of dear to my heart. You know, and it's not a new thing. Obviously, you see it in places like Northern Ireland, in the troubles there, same as the American Civil War, Vietnam War, more recently the war with the Tamil Tigers, where, you know, brothers would find themselves fighting brothers, which is what I wanted to explore and why I ended up going for the resolution that happens between those two brothers. The water board itself, you know, I see it as a one part of it, I suppose, is a joke in many ways, that Western Australia has never really seen itself part of the rest of Australia. And there's always been quiet mumblings here about secession. And so because of that, I ended up in a civil war situation between the Eastern States and Western Australia. Yeah, with regard to the water board, I just saw it as a corporate control or a government stroke corporate control that just gets out of hand. You know, they don't start off as, you know, gun-toting madmen running around looking after the water, but that's where they end up.
And With Conway, we also revisit the past and we learn about the beginning of the Civil War. And that's where you bring in Captain Charles Fremantle. Can you tell us a bit about his role in the book?
Yeah, well, when I go back, the characters literally dream themselves into the past and you don't know whether they're actually changing things or they're just being part of a change that happens when they find themselves back there. Captain Fremantle was always a bloke that intrigued me. I wanted to imagine a state where what the original kind of settler invaders did, that they didn't have to behave that way, they could have behaved differently. And Fremantle was a classic figure of that. You know, he was a man who was up for a crime. He had committed a crime in London. It was a rape of a woman. His family, who were very wealthy, got him out of the crime. Baron Cottesloe got him into, which is his brother, got him into the Navy. His father was a famous admiral. And a short time later, he finds himself in Western Australia meeting up with the Noongars, a man who, you know, arguably had lost his belief in the empire, partly because of his own bad behaviour and partly because he'd seen the machinations of colonisation up close right around the globe. And so with him, you know, I wanted to imagine one of those first settler invaders who grows a conscience, and he has these dreams given to him by the dogs at Duarte Willardin up, the dreaming figures about a possible future.
There are not many non-Indigenous writers who write about Indigenous life from the inside out, let's say.
Yeah.
Why do you think so many non-Indigenous writers steer away from it?
Well, I don't know. You know, W.E.H. Stanner, one of my heroes, the anthropologist, was talking about this, you know, in the 50s, that Australian artists en masse haven't really engaged with Aboriginal thinking. Now, there's been some changes since then. And sometimes it is such things aren't easy to do. You know, the types of permission I have to seek from people to do the kind of work that I write about isn't always easy. For example, with my first book, I had to get permission from my cultural elder, who was a senior woman in the Gunindjmara tribe in Western Victoria. And out of that book, I had to lose about 150 pages, whereas, you know, Mum just said to me, this is my adopted mum. She said, well, you can't say that, my son. No, that's gone. Oh, no, you can't talk about that, you know, which was a funny process. In terms of why en masse Australians haven't, I don't know. Just inability to access the subject, lack of knowledge about the subject. You know, there's plenty of other countries where the invader settlers, for example, learn the languages of the local people. But in Australia, en masse, we haven't really done that. I mean, I've learnt some languages, but most white fellas haven't. And I always think that's a great shame, because me learning languages opened a lot of doors for me, you know, in terms of my ability to talk about these things.
That was Peter Docker, and his new book, The Water Boys, is published by Fremantle Press. It's an incredibly brave piece of writing. And that's all we have time for this evening. We'll be back next Monday at 7 p.m. with a show dedicated to poetry. Hope you can tune in then. Thanks for listening.